This is KZFR 90.1 FM Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, where we'll be focusing on agriculture's role in fighting the climate crisis.
Pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we'll be interviewing Chicoan Julie Heath on the role that agriculture can play in fighting climate change, both through sustainable farming practices and carbon sequestration.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico's Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County, year-round markets in Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning, and at Third and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And we're supported by the generous contributions of Four Bay Aquatic Center at 930 Garden Drive in Oroville. The Aquatic Center is open Friday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. with kayaks, stand-up paddleboard rentals, and more. There are also camps, classes, a facility rental for private events, and they have a beach. Details at fourbayaquaticcenter.com. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Julie Heath about ag's role in fighting climate change.
And the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. I'm Stephen Chudy. Julie Heath is a retired scientist who admits to developing a low-grade addiction to agricultural webinars and podcasts. Julie is concerned about the climate situation. The only thing that gives her much hope is the movement towards soil health. This is because farmers are capable of dramatically drawing down carbon from our atmosphere and planting it into the soil.
Julie was on our show on July 20th, but we found there was so much more to discuss about this topic. She's also active in the movement to create a national carbon tax. Welcome, Julie Heath. Please give us a summary of what you covered the last time we talked.
Hi, Susan and Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
First, let me thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you again about healthy soils, healthy plants, and a healthy climate. Many people are very pessimistic about humanity's chance to combat the climate situation because of we've pretty much already messed it up so badly, and we don't show a lot of signs of getting our act together. Just a few generations back, we had 280 parts per million of CO2 in the air and a stable climate, and now we're 50% higher, or almost. We really have to stop polluting our air, but we also have to remove a lot of what's already up there if we want to live in a stable world. This is a tall order for sure, but I'm radically optimistic and hope that you will have some hope by the time we finish today.
So you have said that agriculture can play a significant role in fighting climate change. How?
Well, you know, it's not just forests that can draw down carbon into the soil. Every year, 30% of the CO2 that we emit is absorbed by plants all over the world. We just have to enact policy that incentivizes and supports farmers to adopt both profitable and robust farming systems that will allow them to literally save the planet by sequestering carbon back into the soil. What many people don't understand is that we have the tools to do this. We just need the will. Most agricultural soils on the planet have lost from 30% to 75% of their original soil organic carbon to the atmosphere due to conventional farming practices. Because they cause the destruction of microbial life and other life in the soil, which is in tandem with the physical erosion of our topsoils, we have actually lost a third of cropland worldwide due to this type of degradation in about the last 40 years. In addition, it takes a lot of energy to produce the fertilizers and other chemicals that industry has conditioned farmers to use, and that also adds to the climate effect.
A lot of people, Julie, say that we should just cut down big ag, cut it down to size. What's your view?
Well, before I go further, I want to make it crystal clear that I'm actually very pro-farmer. I appreciate so much their strong work ethic and their ability to put food on our tables. They're intelligent, and they do care deeply about the land they steward. You know, we all share the same values and needs. We want clean water, pure air, and healthy food for our families. These people have been following, by and large, the agronomic and scientific knowledge that's been disseminated by our colleges and our mostly well-intentioned scientists and agronomic specialists since the start of the Green Revolution. The only problem is that some of this is proving to be detrimental.
So you have some reservations about these applications of knowledge. For sure, the Green Revolution went awry.
Well, what we're learning from the recent research and from the most innovative farmers is that we've taken some very wrong turns by studying natural systems using a reductionist methodology. For generations, the majority of plant research has been conducted in pots in sterilized soil. But the fact is, nature isn't sterile. In the field, in nature, there is a vast underground ecosystem of organisms that interact with the plants, affecting their health, how they get nutrients, and their ability to combat pests and diseases. So we've been doing our research as though nature is a hydroponic system. But if that were true, I would never see a tree growing out of the crack of a rock wall. By the way, my own background is as a research chemist who synthesized potential medicines. All the new work about the effects on human health of the gut microbiome has also completely changed the way that I look at what I did with my career. So I can really empathize with farmers about needing to change your outlook.
You've also told us that the issues are broader. They involve the whole food supply chain. It's not just about growing food. Tell us more, Julie.
Well, as it stands, about one-third of man-made greenhouse gases worldwide come from our food system. That means the transport, the packaging, the land degradation, the fertilizer, and all those things that go into actually getting the crops to you. And on top of that, we throw out, we literally waste a third of what we produce. So Americans eat an average of about a ton of food each year, and that emits about 2 tons of CO2 equivalents. And I just want to let people know that something that they can do is by changing their diet, it's one of the easiest ways to decrease your carbon footprint. In the United States, on-farm greenhouse gases themselves, not including all the rest of it, are about 11% of our collective footprint. At the same time, farmers are being deeply and increasingly affected by our changing climate. These guys are literally on the front lines of the climate, as the stable weather patterns that they rely on are destabilizing, as we see. There are increasingly destructive droughts, floods, changes in the seasonal weather patterns, and storm events. Not to mention that our local farmers here are dealing with wildfire smoke. Just imagine trying to grow plants with so much of the sunlight blocked all the time. A walnut farmer friend I know says that her walnuts this year are very small. And our wine growers are also finding that wildfire smoke taints the flavor of their grapes. So today I'm hoping that we can discuss some of the emerging scientific fields, but also how some of these new understandings are being applied, not only to agriculture, but even to landscape scale restoration. And when I say scale, I mean big scale, like the size of Belgium.
One of the things that really interests me is that farmers can put carbon back in the soil. Can you explain how that works?
Well, it turns out that a truly healthy soil is just teeming with tiny creatures like bacteria and fungi and algae and protozoa and nematodes and earthworms and all kinds of other things, both alive and dead. And these things form the microbiome. They are all carbon-based creatures like we are. And so soil organic carbon is, in essence, a measure of the amount of life that is in the soil. These organisms of the microbiome play a massive role in plant health. They deliver nutrients to the plants and fight diseases and pests, which is why plants actually devote a huge amount of their photosynthetic energy, like 20 to 50% of what they get from the sun, to making sugars to feed the underground workforce. I used to think of a root like a straw that's just used to suck nutrients and water from the soil, but in fact, plants also use these roots to release sugars that they made from the sun energy into the soil as what are called exudates. In return, the biology that's down there that can swim around or move things from place to place, it mines minerals from rock, they fix nitrogen, change the pH of the soil right next to the root, transport nutrients back to the plant's root system. So this is a sort of a new understanding of the soil microbiome that shows that chemically sterilized concrete like dirt just is not what plants need. They need this healthy microbiome in soil to thrive. Just like we are learning about the microbiome inside of humans, we ourselves are actually have more cells that are microbes than they are human. So that our physical body has more microbes in it than it has human cells. We also need to have a healthy microbiome. So, but back to plants, healthy roots have a biology that is aggregated together, and it looks kind of like dreadlocks clinging to them if you pull them out of the ground. So the soil texture that's around that kind of a biological system, it looks like cottage cheese.
So how much carbon can we sequester? You mentioned Belgium earlier. Is this a significant amount? Can we do it on scale?
Well, I certainly hope that we can scale it up. With practices that make the underground workforce thrive, soil organic carbon will increase. And now that amount depends on regional effects, of course. But the UN right now has an initiative called the 4P1000 that launched in 2015. And they estimate that an annual growth rate of 0.4% in the world's soil carbon stocks, you know, in agriculture mostly, or about 0.4% per year, in about the first 12 inches of soil would completely negate the amount of carbon dioxide equivalents that are related to human activities that we're putting out in 1 year.
Wow.
It's a lot. After all, the soil is one of the largest carbon sinks in the world. It stores 2 to 3 times what's in the atmosphere, or about 2,500 billion tons of carbon.
If I were a farmer, I'd be asking what's in it for me. Don't crop yields go up and down and bring the farm's profitability down with them?
Well, the increase in the soil carbon underground workforce makes crops more healthy, and it turns the soil into a sponge for water. That's what's so amazing about this story. It's each 1% of more soil organic carbon absorbs about 27,000 gallons more water per acre, which is going to help when you're in a drought. And also the water infiltrates way more quickly because of that different soil structure and all the space that it creates underneath, rather than running off. So the surface is running off of the surface and being lost or becoming a flood. The need for fertilizers, pesticides, and other inputs is also going to decrease dramatically over time, especially when you get above 3% soil organic carbon. This is a win-win for farmers because healthier soils are giving you lower input costs. You know, you don't have to buy the fertilizer, the NPK, and those kinds of things. And the yield usually stabilizes at similar levels to what the conventional farming system started at. So there's more profit for the farmers.
We had mentioned the last time you were on the show that in some areas, because of fertilizers, the soil is really just holding up the plants. So it's a big change for farmers. Is this change easy for farmers to do?
Yes. So it is an investment of time and effort and learning. And each farm, as every farmer knows, every individual farm has its own differences. So if it were me, I would actually hire a specialist to help me do the transition as quickly as possible, because there's some people out there that can really do that. Cutting inputs prematurely before you've replaced the inputs with, you know, biology, it can be a real problem. So the microbiome can be regenerated within a few seasons, and there's a very big, growing, and welcoming community of people who have made it work.
So how do we know that renewing the microbiome can actually benefit both agriculture and soil carbon stores?
Well, there's been a whole lot done, but I'm just going to, because I really am impressed by it, call out the amazing groundbreaking work that's been done by our local microbiologist and farmer, Dr. David Johnson, from Chico State and his wife, Wu-Chun Su. They have created a fungal-dominant compost system that's called the Johnson Su Bioreactor. This thing takes a full year to mature, so it's not fast. And what they get is this clay-like material that contains a full, mature, and very complex microbiome. And that can actually be suspended in water and placed in the furrows when you, you know, to inoculate the soils when you're planting seeds. So having all that diverse biology right at the seed when it germinates is a game changer. Dr. Johnson is down to using only about 2 pounds an acre of this stuff to regenerate the soil's microorganism bank. The results from his work for farmers are just stunning. For example, a cotton field trial showed 1.5 times the production of a conventionally farmed field using just the Johnson Su stuff and no fertilizer. There was a corn trial just finished not that long ago on 77 acres of Howard Buffett's research farm, where they compared three sections of the field, one with just the Johnson Su inoculant, one with the Johnson Su that had 15% of the normal amount of nitrogen, and then versus the conventionally farmed where there's 256 units of nitrogen on it. When you looked at the fields, they looked the same. The corn looks the same. The yields were, which is where, what matters, right, were the same for both the conventional and for the 15% nitrogen parts of the field. And that's just the first season before the biology is really established around it. The Johnson Su was only, by itself with no fertilizer, was only 6% lower. So repairing the microbiome replaced about 218 units of nitrogen per acre. Rejuvenating the microbiome can also help sequester carbon at a very elevated rate. In a 4.5-year field study, and I forget the crop, they sequestered 19 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per acre per year, which is actually 20 to 50 times the carbon increase that was seen in comparison no-till soils. Now, this is compost that farmers can make themselves for about 25 cents an acre. Mm.
So how do farmers who don't use Johnson Su compost typically to make their soil healthier?
Well, there are quite a few methods, and actually I hope that everybody gets the picture that you use the Johnson Su and these methods. Mm-hmm. Our National Resources Conservation Service has 5 main principles that they say to use as a guide. 1, keep the soil covered. This insulates it from excess heat and cold, which kill microbes, and decreases wind and water erosion. Minimize soil disturbance from things like deep tillage and prevent the disruption of that soil microbial ecosystem, especially the fungal networks, by doing that. Increase plant diversity. Have continual live plants and roots to feed the biology. What this usually means is planting cover crops that they're not harvested to sell in the market. They're just there to feed the biology. These are planted in the off season rather than leaving the ground uncovered and unprotected and unfed for months on end. And then finally, livestock integration into normal farms. It's been shown that what comes out of the back end of an animal is hugely efficient at feeding the microbial ecosystem. Even cows that are raised on pasture in a controlled rotational grazing system actually sequester significant carbon, unlike those living in controlled animal feedlots where most of us get our meat. It's not the cow, it's how she's managed. And for bonus points, there are a lot of soil health experts, like I had said before, that believe you should really minimize all chemical inputs as much as possible.
You talk about this new science, and we're curious about that. What should our listeners know about what this new science is?
Well, the microbiome in general, I think because there's better tools for studying it, it's getting a lot of focus in the last, say, 1 to 1.5 decades, both around plant health and human health. how microbes and plants interact and how microbes affect plant health and nutrient density. So there's new work also on how insects determine which plants to eat and other things like that. If there was more time, I'd love to get into the weeds, but I'm going to settle for giving you sort of a 30,000-foot overview. For some listeners, I'm going to say it straight out. If you've got some farmers out there, they might find that some of these statements need to be backed up by the experts. And so I'm going to provide you some links to my source material for your show notes. In plants, the story is that a healthier microbiome makes for healthier plants, which I keep saying. They're less drought sensitive. They catch illnesses less readily, and all of these, and they can also repel pests better, all while building carbon in the soil. The plants rely on this underground biology to bring them nutrients, and in return they make sugars to feed the microbes. Free-floating bacteria exist which fix nitrogen for the plant, as well as legumes could do, reducing farmers' need for nitrogen. Fungi, like mycorrhizal fungi, will bring them nutrients from great distances because it's this large, like web-like structure under the ground. Other organisms can take the abundant acidified phosphorus that exists under the soil that's not bioavailable and change the local pH of the root so it makes the phosphorus available to the plants, again, reducing the need to apply any. The biology also brings a lot of other micronutrients that the plants need to flourish. Humans also need these micronutrients, by the way, and it's been determined by the WHO that nutrients in plants have decreased by about eightfold in our food since the 1940s. Nutritional density in our food also correlates really well with soil health management practices, which give you a healthy underground workforce, and this leads, of course, to healthier humans. There's a device that's now being created, the first iteration is already for sale, where you can flash a light and find out the actual nutrient density of your carrot or your tomato or whatever that is, you know, your food. This will make it easier for us, including consumers, to know what to eat, you know, and by eating well, we can then also improve the climate. There are also new tools like sap analysis for plants. This is sort of like doing a blood analysis on a human being. And as you can imagine, the information you get from that is a lot more relevant to what does the plant need than some chemical soil test where you're extracting with chemicals and trying to figure out what's actually just in the dirt. I would like everybody to really get this key concept that soil is alive. It literally breathes, and there are soil respiration rates that can be measured by something called the Haney test. We're also very misunderstanding insect pressures. Over time, farmers have been applying more and more and more insecticide, and yet we find that the insect bad actor insect pressures in the fields have not decreased. This is in part because we're also killing all the thousands of beneficial insects that might eat those bad actors or push them away or things like that. Yet we keep applying more and more of these chemicals every year. Also, the health of the plants will affect whether insects can actually digest them. So insects are kind of like garbage collectors. They go and get the unhealthy plants and they eat them. They don't eat very, very healthy plants. Insects cannot digest plants once they get to a certain stage of health, so they just pass them by. We also now know that insects literally use their antennae to detect which plants are weak, and those are the ones they attack. They detect them by the vibrational wavelengths of indicator molecules that are inside those plants, and they can detect it from a distance. Now, that sounds like mumbo-jumbo, possibly, but I have to tell you, in my work as a chemist, I actually used these wavelengths. They were part of my toolbox for identifying compounds and figuring out what they were. So as humans, we need fancy equipment to detect the wavelengths, but insects are able to detect them. You know, they just have that ability. Kind of like dogs have a way better noses than we do, insects have these abilities to detect these kinds of wavelengths. The exciting thing is that farmers can also use something called a Brix test that determines the sugar content of their plant leaves. And that will tell them how healthy is the plant. So when they have, when plants are healthier, they have more sugars in their leaves. And we actually know numbers now for the levels above which insects literally will not attack them. And that's, again, because the insects do not have the enzymes to digest healthy plants. Just sort of the way that we don't have the enzymes to digest hay, but horses do.
Mm. You also mentioned water retention and soil carbon earlier. Let's talk about that. We are currently in a mega drought here in California. A lot of farmers are in trouble. What more should we understand in terms of how water is involved with the landscape?
Well, as you know, water is life, and how it acts within the landscape is controlled by both the physical shape of that landscape and also the plants and the soil organisms that are present. Most of us don't understand all that much about how the water cycle works, yet this is vital to how our landscapes get water and become fertile. We usually view water as a zero-sum game. It's a commodity to be rationed out. But in reality, this stuff is constantly in motion through the landscape, and the best way to deal with it to promote fertility is to slow its progress through the landscape. By doing this, we can bring whole landscapes back into vibrant life. Just a quick example, I visited Rio de Janeiro a couple of years ago, and maybe you remember from the Olympics that they have these tall hills right by the ocean, and they're lush forested hillsides. They're covered in streams and waterfalls and tons of fog. Well, it turns out that in the early years after the city was first settled, the settlers systematically cut that forest down, leaving the hills denuded. Then they realized their mistake because the water left, and I mean it like really left. There was no water source in the hot summer. You can imagine that that's a bit of a logistical problem in the 1800s. So they hired some people to replant the entire watershed's mountainous slopes with native trees, and within a few years, the rain and the lush growth all returned.
That's a huge effect. Has that kind of thing been seen elsewhere?
Absolutely. This is not an isolated example, and a key point that I would like every person listening to come away with is that it is possible to regenerate desertified and degraded landscapes. This can be done in just a few years with a concerted effort, doing the right things. There is a book out there called The Reindeer Chronicles, which describes a number of projects, but I'm just going to tell you about one real mind blower that I referred to earlier. The Los Plateau in China was the cradle of their ancient civilization. As you might imagine, this place started out really fertile and lush, like a true Garden of Eden, similar to all of the places, really, that civilization was first established. Over thousands of years, man degraded it by farming methods and the like until it was almost a moonscape. I'd like you to picture the modern Jordanian desert with its devegetated, rocky hillsides. The people living there were the poorest in China. They scratched out a meager living by grazing goats on any teeny bit of grass that managed to peek out. I mean, it was bleak. People couldn't marry because they couldn't afford to. Every year, massive quantities of topsoil, which had been laid down by the ancient glaciers, were eroding away. And this is actually the source of that yellow color in the Yellow River. Mm. When dry, the wind would blow these huge dust storms into the nearby cities, blocking the sun, like our smoke
yes.
right now.
Yes.
This region was considered pretty much beyond hope. So the Los Plateau, the whole thing is the size of France. It's huge. In 1994, there was a restoration project launched that covered an area the size of Belgium. They made grazing of animals illegal and hired the residents to terrace the hills. They planted these vast water-infiltrating terraces thickly with trees and other vegetation. And today, that region is vibrant green, lush, productive farming area with prosperous people. The project has been documented in a film by John Liu, and the time-lapse photography is something you simply have to see to believe, just looking out over these vast landscapes, how they've changed. I think it's amazing that everyone doesn't know the story. It's so extraordinary.
It is extraordinary and inspiring. Do you have other examples?
I just refer to a couple. They're in India right now. They are doing these Pani, that's the name of the organization, water competitions, where there are these parched villages where they've run out of water to the point where they have to rely on the government to send drinking water on trucks in the summer. So they are doing these competitions where they pit different villages against each other to do the best job of capturing water. And they sculpt their hillsides kind of similar to what I just described so that it'll so that when the monsoons do come, the rain will stay in the landscape instead of running off. So these are wildly successful, and what they're seeing is that farming prosperity is restored, drinking water doesn't have to be trucked in, and the young people stop moving away. There's also something called the Great Green Wall in Africa, where they're pushing back the deserts there, and there are others. Looking around, I have to say I fear that we are watching California, our lovely home, slowly become a desert. Part of that is the changing climate, of course, and part of it is also the way that we're managing our water and our landscape. Back in Bidwell's day, there were marshes and beavers around Chico. It was wet. Down in the valley near Bakersfield, which is my hometown, there was a massive lake called the Tulare Lake. And when the missionaries were founding this state, you could canoe, it's been documented, from Bakersfield all the way up to the San Francisco Bay. Since then, we have disrupted our water cycle completely. And this is being, of course, compounded by climate change as things warm up. We don't even understand how much has been lost, or by extension, how much we really have to gain if we could change our practices to be more in harmony with nature. One thing we do know for sure is that our redwoods are already having to move north because our coastal fog is down by 2 hours a day compared with the 1970s.
Mm. How can we understand why these kinds of landscape regeneration projects are so successful?
Well, we all know that carbon affects the climate, but something that people don't talk about or don't think about much, so does water. It's also kind of a greenhouse gas. So water is a little less well studied, but calculations by soil scientists and climate specialist Walter Ginny predict that we can make a game-changing difference to the heat of our planet by managing water and plants better. I'd like to talk you through the rationale, and I'm going to borrow Dee Dee Purcell's wonderful thought experiment because these rely on things we already know to be true. So close your eyes and try to picture yourself taking off your shoes and socks on a hot summer day and then stand on the sun under the sun on a black asphalt street. So, ouch, right? Mm-hmm. Then look around. Maybe you see a park with some bare soil. That's better, right? Then maybe walk into a muddy patch of soil where kids have been playing. And then walk onto the grass. Keep noticing how your feet are feeling. Look around. Maybe there's some trees and a few bushes. Go stand near them, but still under the sun. Perhaps you're starting to get a little bit of a cool breeze coming through now. Then if you move under the trees, maybe in Bidwell Park, until you're in the middle of this beautiful green forest with lush undergrowth, you find a dramatic decrease in temperature. So see, you already know the cooling potential of water in the soil and plants and diverse lush green landscapes. Here's the science behind that. we know that the soil biology will stick to the sand, silt, and clay particles. It will aggregate them together into this sponge-like soil structure, like I mentioned earlier. When the biology is present, the soil becomes less compacted, and it has these pore spaces in it. But it still holds together, just like a sponge. And they're calling this the soil carbon sponge. I wish I had a photo so I could show you how much they really resemble each other. So now a second experiment. I want you to think about a plate that has a cup of flour mounted on top of it. This resembles the structure of dirt. Dirt is something that is not alive, that lacks biology. Imagine dripping water onto that dried out flour like as if it were raining. What happens is that very little of that water will soak in. It just splashes, compacts the soil or the flour in this case. You see runoff, you see erosion, but very little infiltration of the water into the actual flour or soil, however you want to think of it. You'll see flooding downstream and drought just as soon as the water stops flowing. So you see drought and flooding in the same landscape. Very little water is going down in. For dead dirt with this structure, the water, of course, is not really reaching the plant roots when it rains. So this, again, is a setup for wildfires because the plants are stressed and they're susceptible to diseases and pests. There's more deadwood on the ground because there's less life in the soil to actually decompose the deadwood. And when you have this lack of the soil carbon sponge or the microbial life, degraded soils, which are what we get, degraded soils, which is what we have all over our planet. Recall that I mentioned we've degraded about 30% of the Earth's cropland in the last 40 years. And in our own corn belt, apparently 24 to 46% of topsoil has been lost. By contrast, if you add biology to your flour, like say yeast, you can make bread, right? Bread resembles an aggregated soil structure. It's got it has the biology in it. It's not quite the same because you kill the yeast when you cook them, but it has a pore structure and it has the ability not to fall apart when it gets rained on. So let's see. So if you rain on that, the water will soak into the little air pockets just like it, as if it were a sponge, and they stay there until the entire thing is saturated. You can add at least 9 times as much water to that as you can to that flour example that I told you about a minute ago. So that's more rain before a flood happens and more that can be held in the soil to prevent drought further on and give the plants what they need.
So plants and good soil and make us cooler, and water goes into the ground, and there's strong biology in the ground. How can this affect global cooling?
Right. So all the water that's now at the root zone for plants and microbes to use, as the plants grow, they transpire, which is sort of like how if you think about us sweating, they evaporate out water into the surrounding air. And it cools them down. They do it partly to cool themselves, and they also do it because they need to do something with the excess water that they actually generate during photosynthesis. That phase shift of liquid water to water vapor in the air inherently costs energy, as those who have studied chemistry will know. It takes heat energy that we can measure with a thermometer and locks it into the actual energetic state of the water molecules themselves, effectively cooling the surrounding air. This type of cooling happens both when we sweat and when the plant photosynthesizes and transpires. The important point is that it's not only cooling the plant leaf, but that is also taking energy and cooling the surrounding air around the plant. The water that transpires then rises in the atmosphere until you get to a point where enough of it's up there that it begins to recondense, and that's how we get clouds. So if you have more plants on the ground transpiring, then you have more water going up into the air, and you're getting more clouds. That leads, obviously, to more rain. So clouds also directly cool the planet by when sun hits them from above and they're all white, they reflect heat back into space. That is called the albedo effect. So you have both of those effects happening that are both cooling to the atmosphere. So, and in a third effect is that when you have more clouds, the cooler low pressure zone that's under the clouds has a tendency to draw in clouds from other places, and that increases the cooling effect even more. So there's three different ways here that the cooling is happening in the to the surrounding atmosphere. In our region, up in Northern California, I have to say, if we had much better plant cover on the ground, this effect would be sucking clouds in from over the Pacific Ocean into our Central Valley. If the Central Valley were all in cover crops and agroforestry, then we probably wouldn't be having such a bad drought. Instead, to save water, we see vast areas where farmers are leaving their fields bare to save water. That is exacerbating the problem by creating a large heat dome that pushes any moisture that gets near us up and drives it away from the region. So the bottom line is rain brings more rain, and also trees and plants bring more rain.
That sounds like a lot like what you said about Rio replanting the hills to get the rain back, right? So we could perhaps replant California to get the rain back?
Yeah, there's actually a... there's an organization that's part of what this BD Herhaus has formed. It's called Rehydrate California. But yeah, it's the same effect, and this is easily found happening all over the world. When we cut down forests, like in the Amazon or wherever, or burn them down, then the rains go away. But when a forest is replanted with diverse species, then the rains will come back. So the bottom line for this story is that if we want more rain, we need to avoid bare soil, period. So I have to say that learning all of this stuff has really changed my own outlook. When I travel around, I just find it so painful to look at bare ground. I much prefer a big, weedy area to something that's bare and so-called clean.
Yes, right. We're, yes. My son, the farmer, says the same thing, no bare ground. We're getting to the end of the program here. So what are some other things that you'd like to mention in our last few minutes here?
Yeah, so I'd also like people to know, we keep talking about the microbiome. Walter Yene, this guy I mentioned before, has found that the easiest way to get water vapor, like clouds, to condense to the point where it's heavy enough to fall in as rain is to add a certain type of bacteria. So our air also has a microbiome that's coming, you know, it's bacteria are going into the air, and that exists. Your listeners may know about this type of bacteria because they use it to make snow for ski resorts. And this is detectable in our atmosphere, and it might be a very, very important part of the water cycle. Now, there's studies sort of ongoing about that, so I don't want to overstate, but I would say that killing off all our bacteria and soil and plants is maybe not a great idea.
Our listeners are a pretty energetic and activist group. What can they do on a personal level to help speed the soil health movement and generally get involved in climate action?
Oh, there's so many things. And again, I was saying I'll give you some links to the show notes, and I'll put some ideas in there. But I would like to quote an old Irish proverb, which says, you'll never plow a field by turning it over in your mind. Every one of us can do something that would make a difference. You know, try not to waste food, because currently we're producing food that's causing climate change, and then we're throwing it away, you know, about a third of what we produce. When you eat, I would suggest that you try to eat more plants. and try to buy from farmers, if you can, that are doing some of these practices that I mentioned above. Even just picking the things that say non-GMO, that helps, because at least, you know, you're not buying the Roundup-ready crops. Roundup is a microbial killer, and we're applying it all over our country. And so if and when you choose to eat meat, if you can try to buy the soil health regeneratively type raised type, that would be hugely important, because regeneratively farmed beef can be a net benefit to the carbon balance. But cows that are raised in feedlot are by far the highest emitters in our food chain, because you feed them corn and soy off of these big farms, and then they, you know, so you're doing all the destruction on that farm, and then you're feeding it to the cow for a long period of time. And of course, everybody's heard about cow burps, but all of those things are kind of a negative. So a lot of people do a meatless Monday, or I suggest just eat a lot of vegetables at the beginning of a meal and eat less meat at the end. That makes a difference. For the climate action part, you can join and volunteer with the Citizens Climate Lobby at ccclusa.org and get involved in asking for agricultural policies like the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which I won't go into, but it's attempting to support farmers to change their practices and also, you know, get involved with other climate legislation. You could also join another climate action group. There's the Northern California Climate Action, Chico Sunrise, or Butte County 350 are all around here.
Mm-hmm. And so where can people get more information about sustainable agriculture?
Yeah, like I say, there will be the show notes, and I'll have links to a whole lot of talks there. But as for organizations, I would highly recommend Chico State. They have a Center for Regenerative Agriculture and Resilient Systems, where they basically study this type of agriculture. Now, or there's Kiss the Ground is a good organization, or Dr. Elaine Ingham has a soil food web organization that's also really good. In terms of podcasts, if you're a farmer out there, I suggest highly that you just start with episode one of the Regenerative Agriculture podcast with John Kemp. This guy has interviewed just about everybody of note by now. He's an excellent communicator, and he really gives a thoughtful presentation. So I highly recommend that podcast.
Thank you so much, Julie Heath, for being with us tonight on Ecotopia. You packed a remarkable amount of information, and it's very persuasive. Your vision of a green planet with soil regenerated is very persuasive and doesn't look that difficult to do. It takes the will, not necessarily a lot of high tech to do it.
Yeah, I don't think it's a lot of high tech. I think it's you know, there's some good old-fashioned back-breaking muscle work in trying to change the way that we have hillsides structured so that they hold water. And I didn't get into anything about permaculture or how, you know, there's a whole study of how to make water run more slowly through the landscape. But yeah, there's a lot happening, and I just hope that your listeners will be happy to have heard some about it, and then they'll be a little bit more aware.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Julie.
I just wanted to thank you too. It was really super of you guys to have me on.
Thank you so much. Information really helpful.
Thank you.
listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Two important meetings coming up this week in Chico. Just an hour from now, an hour and 5 minutes, at 7 o'clock, Council Member, County Supervisor. Deborah Lucero and others have organized a meeting about the proposed Tuscan Water District, which is a major threat to our area. It would kind of privatize water in the lower half of Butte County. A lot of people are upset about it. A lot of people are fighting it. A lot of big ag is in favor of it. Guess why? It would give them more control over what is essentially our water in the Tuscan Aquifer. This is at the Masonic Center over on West East Street. If you want to attend it by Zoom, it's a very long Zoom address. The best bet is to go to thechicoer.com and Google or search for Tuscan Aquifer, and it'll give you the link. You can sit in by Zoom, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Masonic Center, a very important meeting. Then on Thursday, the Butte Environmental Council will sponsor a discussion about wildfires, environment, and climate. This will be August 26th, Thursday, from, do I have the date right? Yes, it's Thursday.
Yes.
6 to 8 p.m., it'll be at the Bidwell Bowl Amphitheater, or online at bit.ly/BeckWildfireForum. And again, if you just go to BeckNet, they will give you that link. They'll bring together experts on wildfire and the environment, including Don Hankins, professor of geography, Sandrine Matasek, co-associate professor in environmental science at Chico State, Callie Jane DeAnda, whom we interviewed a few weeks ago on Ecotopia. She's the executive director of Butte County Fire Safe. And Wolfie Rugel, who's also been on our show. She's part of the Prescribed Burn Association and coordinator of Butte County Resource Conservation District. Coming up at 7 in just a few minutes, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. Tonight she'll be interviewing Tom Hess on Iyengar Yoga. And then at 7:30, it's the Ginger Nichols Show, Radioactive.
Radioactive.
Thank you.
And then next week we will have a guest, as yet undecided, for more of a discussion of this Tuscan Water District. And then the following week we'll have a program that focuses on disasterology from Samantha Montano of the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website. You can get notes and information about Julie's comments tonight, which will be on our website. And we have lots of other resources. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. And we also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
You are the new day. You are the new day. I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new day.
Next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothes and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years and is located at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by the Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image is open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling